Come in, come in, and welcome to the Cave of the Echo Chamber. This is a podcast brought to you by the journalists of ENDS Report, exploring the most important environmental policy in the UK, with me, your host, James Adjipon-Parsons. In this week's episode, we'll be discussing Labour's Net Zero Secretary Ed Miliband and the party's abandoned flagship £28 billion annual fund to combat climate change. We'll also be chatting about a controversial move by the National Park Authority of Dartmoor to seek changes in the way sites of special scientific interest are graded, that some say is a backward step for nature. And the news that lawyers are trying to take the government to court after Energy Secretary Claire Catino approved plans for Drax to install carbon capture technology at its Yorkshire biomass plant. But what's the rub? We'll find out. And for our deep dive, we'll be speaking with insect and biodiversity net gain expert Nat Duffus from the University of Oxford on why net gain might be neglecting one of nature's most important living organisms on this planet. So let's explore this week's Echo Chamber! To help me on my expedition into the cave of big green news this week, I'm joined by ENDS Report's news editor Pippa Neal and features editor Tess Colley. So for our first story, it's the bacon butty-loving Ed Miliband and a discussion about his first public speech since his party abandoned plans to bolster climate pledges, that's that £28 billion green pot, if they were to be elected. Tess, you were at this Green Alliance think tank talk with old Ed speaking. Did he shed light on that missing £28 billion?
No, is the short answer. Everyone kind of turned up at this event thinking, you know, it's the first time he's spoken since the big U-turn. What's he going to say? It was sort of framed in that way. It's the first speech. And then he didn't really address it in his keynote. And then it didn't come up in the panel Q&A. And eventually it did come up in the audience Q&A. And he was asked if he would rule out weakening any more of Labour's green energy plans. And what he said was, we've set out our plan that we're sticking to. And he added that the party has said very publicly and very clearly what the investment is going to be in each of the areas, and that that will be the position going into the manifesto, as Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have both made clear. So that is all he said on the matter. So yeah, not as juicy as maybe people might have wondered if he would be, but they've been so careful in the run-up to the election, aren't they?
And did you have any probing questions for our dear Ed?
Well, once the £28 billion elephant in the room was addressed, what I was interested in was how maybe nature and land use reforms were going to work into the net zero plans. Because he did mention it in his speech, he gave a very brief mention to how the profound threat that biodiversity decline poses. And, you know, there's lots of talk certainly in the environment sector about, you know, climate and nature. The climate and nature crisis are two sides of the same coin. So I asked, would there be any explicit funding commitments relating to net zero land use reforms? But he did not give a direct response to that either, unfortunately. He just said that the importance of nature and biodiversity was something that he has discussed both with Keir and Rachel as part of Labour's, and I quote, overall plans.
Fantastic. We know no more.
Yeah, sorry, everyone.
Not you. Just Ed. So, judging by that, I mean, what was your take on his speech and the event itself?
Well, overall, I think, you know, he said all the sort of right things that people want to hear. He thing about Ed Miliband is he really knows his stuff, and you can tell that when, the way he talks, the way he answers questions, he really, you know, he understands the detail. He even refers to himself as a nerd, which I think he quite likes doing, because he said it like twice, like talking about the second and first edition of these particular reports. And, you know, he pleased green groups, many of whom were in the audience, that, you know, he did actually state in his speech that, you know, nature got a mention, basically, which is not always the case. That went down well. And he sort of mentioned that, he's going to be working closely with Steve Reed, the Shadow Environment Secretary. That went down well. I thought what was interesting was that he clearly is making this sort of move to say, look, you know, it's not like all conservative. Anyone who's ever voted conservative hates the environment. That's not the case. You know, you've had previously really big green leaders in the Conservative Party, like Alok Sharma, the previous COP president, and Theresa May, who signed in the Climate Change Act, but they're all gone and they don't speak for the Conservatives anymore, but Labour does. And that's an interesting political argument, I think. It's saying, you know, just because you voted for them in the past before their green pledges, they don't represent that anymore.
And that leads us on quite nicely to our second story of the week, where Energy Secretary Claire Catino isn't always looked upon favourably by environmentalists, and particularly after she approved plans for Drax Power Limited to create the world's largest bioenergy with carbon capture and storage project, the acronym BECCS. Now, it was a controversial decision at the time, as there were concerns that the expansion project would have substantial negative impacts on issues such as air pollution, detrimental effects on protected species. There were wider concerns about the climate impact of Drax's reliance on these burning imported wood pellets from North America. And that is a preamble there, Pippa, but there is an update to this saga, isn't there?
Yeah, so campaign group Biofuel Watch UK has begun the legal process towards judicial review, with lawyers at Lee Day sending a pre-action protocol letter to the government on their behalf. And the kind of crux of this legal action involves EIAs, or environmental impact assessments. And basically, the campaign group is saying that, like, they believe that the Energy Secretary's decision to approve Drax's plans breached the 2017 Infrastructure Planning Environmental Impact Assessment Regulations. And the reason they say that the Environment Secretary breached these regulations is because, as they put it, the likely harmful environmental effects were not assessed or taken into account, and that this was a breach of the regulations. They say that the need for this assessment rests in part because of the size and scale of the project, because it's described as being a nationally significant infrastructure project under a different set of planning regulations, the Planning Act 2008. And according to the legal challenge, the project needed these EIA, or these environmental impact regulations, to be followed carefully before it could be given the go-ahead. And so the group is basically saying this didn't happen, and that's the crux of their legal argument.
Okay, so for those who don't really know much about Drax, can you give us a bit of context about it and its proposals?
So the existing Drax power station in Yorkshire is huge, and it generates around 4% of the country's power and 9% of its electricity output at the moment. But in that context, it's also a huge carbon emitter. So according to the company's 2022 annual report, it emitted more than 12 million tonnes of CO2 that year, making it one of the largest sources of CO2 emissions in the whole of Europe. So yeah, big energy provider, but also a big polluter. And the project it's kind of proposing is this new carbon capture project, which is projected to create 8 million tonnes of so-called negative emissions each year by capturing the carbon dioxide that's produced from two of its burners with this kind of new technology. So it will kind of capture emissions that would otherwise be released and store them under the North Sea. It's a very kind of simplified way of explaining it. And if you kind of look at what Drax has to say, it believes that this project could save the UK up to £15 billion in whole economy costs between 2030 and 2050. And it says it will help the government meet its climate emissions targets.
Although those numbers and savings are contested, it should be said, by different environmental groups on what is a saving.
Ed Miliband did get asked about Drax as well at the event, because it's quite, as we discussed, controversial issue. And he was very, very cautious in his response. But he basically said biomass technology, like we see at Drax, is part of the net zero pathway. But, you know, he was very, very cautious about it. So, yeah, that was interesting.
Yes. So he wasn't going to pin his colours to the mast then?
No. Well, other than to say it's not a definite no, but it's not a wholehearted yes.
So this is something that Claire Catino is dealing with now. What are the planning issues that the campaign group have brought against her?
So as I kind of explained, the crux of this is all to do with these EIA regulations. And the group is claiming that the Environment Secretary failed to comply with these regulations in three ways. So firstly, they say that by treating the project as if it would produce no greenhouse gas emissions, they're kind of contesting that and saying that that's not true. And secondly, by excluding the CO2 emissions from the units to be fitted with the carbon capture technology, again, that's contested. And finally, they say that by treating the works to actually construct and operate the transport and storage facilities for the captured carbon as a separate project, that kind of, yeah, again, that shouldn't have been done, basically. And on that last point, the Humber Low Carbon Pipelines project, which will transfer the CO2 burned from the biomass to this store in rock formations under the North Sea, the campaigners say that this is an essential element for the project as a whole, and so it should have been treated as the same project for the purposes of these environmental impact assessment regulations, but it was treated as separate, and that's kind of the crux of their argument. And they say that by not doing these three things, it's effectively allowed the Environment Secretary to treat the project without its carbon tag, which they say is equivalent to 8 million tonnes of CO2. And this is according to Dr. Andrew Boswell, who gave evidence at the planning examination.
Which is so interesting if they were expected to make savings of 8 million tonnes with the scheme. So what did Drax have to say about this?
So when I got in touch, a Drax spokesperson just said that any legal challenge of the Secretary of State's decision would be a matter for the government. And they said they remain confident in the development timeline for the project. So yeah, I guess we'll just have to see kind of how this legal action progresses.
ENN's also contacted the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero for comment, but alas, nothing has been received. So we will move swiftly on to our final story of the day, where we're taking you listeners to the millennia-strewn lands of Dartmoor, with news that the way we view these protected sites may be changing. Tess, you have the story. What's happening in Dartmoor?
Yes, so in Dartmoor, the National Park Authority is basically seeking a mandate from the government to change how the protected sites in the national park are monitored, which, in the way they sort of have framed it, would remove the current focus on nature and on the ecological condition of the sites to focus on a suite of public benefits, to use their phrase. And so the background to this is it comes in the wake of what was called the Thursden Review, ordered last year by Farming Minister Mark Spencer, which all comes from a big fallout between Natural England and farmers in the national park. Because to summarise quite a prolonged debate here, Natural England told farmers they needed to remove some livestock from the national park where they're farming if that was on a protected site. And farmers said, this is going to ruin our businesses. No way. What are you talking about? So there's been this review, there's lots of unhappiness, there's a bit of a feeling amongst some green groups that this is like the canary in the coal mine of people trying to remove Natural England's powers. So now we've got the National Park Authority seeking to say that it should have the mandate to develop a new way of assessing protected sites, which isn't just about nature. But it's interesting because, you know, according to an ENN's investigation last year, we found that just 19% of Dartmoor's SSSIs are in favourable condition. And that's despite 30.3 million worth of payments issued to Dartmoor farmers since 2009 under kind of green farming schemes. There's more about that on our website if you want to go and look at ennsreport.com/wilderness. But yeah, that's the latest development.
We've touched on it, but how have the National Park Authority sort of framed this move?
They say in this report that they wrote themselves for their own members to approve a meeting earlier this month. They frame it saying, no, it's not, this review of SSSI shouldn't be about weakening nature protection, but looking at how best to measure nature recovery. What it says is, at present, SSSI condition is used as the measure of nature recovery, yet there is an acceptance by many that favourable condition is not a representative measure of environmental condition, especially for large moorland SSSI. It doesn't actually say who these many people are, but that's what it states. And it sort of cites the Thursden Review as providing an opportunity for us to look at this again, more or less. And essentially, they seem to be making the case that designations need to be, well, firstly, more easily understood, scientifically robust is their phrase, can maybe take a systems approach that looks at a range of things like health of soils, habitat, species, but basically not just having this, in their view, I guess, single focus on nature. They literally says not just nature in the report, in brackets. Okay. That's where we're at.
I mean, it is interesting. It's probably worth saying or reiterating that Natural England does use scientifically robust data to inform its decisions. They're not just guessing.
Well, yes, exactly. This is the thing. They do use scientifically robust measures. In fact, really, that is exactly what they're looking at. These protected sites that we're really talking about are these sites of special scientific interest. They're designated for a particular feature, which can be normally some sort of ecological or geological feature. And then their job as Natural England, it's their statutory purpose, is to make sure that these sites are kept in a good condition. Perhaps they're not doing a particularly good job of it at the moment because a lot of our sites aren't in a good condition, but they would say that they're trying their best and they're working in a world where farming practices have negatively impacted the landscape.
It sounds like an interesting spin, what's going on, and possibly even sincere. Perhaps National Park Authority members will see it as a benefit if we can be more holistic in our vision, they might say. But some campaigners haven't responded kindly, have they, Pippa?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. There's been definitely some angry responses on social media. But Eleanor Grice, who's from the grassroots rewilding campaign group Wildcard and is also a member of the Alliance for Nature on Dartmoor, said that national parks, SSSIs, are there for nature, full stop, and to suggest that they should now be assessed on social, economic and cultural criteria because restoring them for nature is too difficult is frankly shocking and completely dilutes their prime purpose. And Guy Shrubsole, who's the author of Who Owns England and who's also part of the Alliance for Nature on Dartmoor, said that any attempt to kind of change how the SSSI is assessed is essentially an attempt to change the monitoring rules to get the right results, rather than actually tackling the parlous state of protected sites on Dartmoor.
And in response to those criticisms, do we have a reply from the National Park Authority, Tess?
Well, I went to the National Park Authority for a response specifically on those concerns raised by the campaigners, and they didn't really give me one. They did give me a response which said, you know, it confirmed basically that the National Park Authority members had agreed to endorse the findings of the Fursden review and that the authority remains committed to working with all partners to the benefit of Dartmoor as a whole. But they did not really acknowledge the points raised by the campaigners. I also asked the government whether the National Parks proposal is something DEFRA is either actively considering or open to considering in Dartmoor. DEFRA didn't acknowledge the proposal at all in its response, but they said SSSIs represent England's best wildlife and geological sites and are vital to achieving nature recovery, and that they will be responding to the Fursden review shortly.
It's time now for our moment of the week where we discuss something fun, funky, fresh, weird, downright strange. Pippa, what's your moment of the week?
This is an amazing story where basically a member of the public found what they thought was a baby hedgehog to then realise it was actually just a bobble from a hat. So it was brought to the Lower Moss Nature Reserve and Wildlife Hospital by a well-meaning rescuer. And on arrival, they discovered that the hoglet, which is the name for a baby hedgehog, which I also didn't know, and it's amazing, was actually just a little pom-pom. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. I swear that's a Specsavers advert. I swear they take the cat to the vets or something.
You're right, that is one.
Yeah. It's the BBC pranking us, I don't know.
Yeah. Early April Fool's Day.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Wow.
Oh, and a baby hedgehog is a?
Hoglet.
Hoglet. I might start calling baubles on a hat a hoglet.
A hoglet. Like your hoglet.
Like your hoglet, mate.
When you see it, there's a little picture of it in a box with some like food next to it in like tissue.
Fantastic.
So they even like held it thought like this is a baby hedgehog.
What a soft baby hedgehog I'm holding.
So light.
So light and fluffy. Tess, do you, a very well deserved moment of the week. Tess, do you have a moment?
Mine also features a baby animal. So employees of the Richmond Wildlife Centre have been wearing a fox mask to interact with an orphaned kit that was brought into the centre. Mm. The idea is it makes it easier for the baby fox to be reintroduced into the wild in the future, but you have to go out and find the video of this because it is absolutely bizarre. It's like Basil Brush is administering medication.
It's quite scary.
It is a bit sinister, but also wonderful. And it's just this what is a person, you assume, in this fox mask.
You assume it's not actually a fox.
Who
knows?
These days.
If a hedgehog's not a hedgehog.
Yeah, we don't know what's what. And it's this tiny little baby fox in the person's hand, but it just looks like a really sinister fox feeding a little foxlet.
And the fox looks cool, though. They've got no problem with the sinister fox.
It looks fine with it.
They're happy with
it. Yeah, I mean, it's a baby fox, so it's probably blind. That might explain why it's so calm.
Right, yeah.
It's true that if it's blind, because surely the smell is the most important thing. I wonder if they... Can it even see?
It has all the ruse just to dress up as a fox.
Yeah.
I missed out Halloween, so here's my turn.
I mean, the Richmond Wildlife Centre is probably not far from the Eco Chamber studio. We could maybe go down and have a look.
Is that where the fox is?
Mm. It says it's Richmond Wildlife Centre.
Amazing. We could. We shall. We'll find out more, listeners, and bring you the news. The There's a bit of a buzz about this week's deep dive as I caught up with biodiversity Nick Gain and bug expert Nat Duffus from the University of Oxford. She's been working with a team of ecological economists, including Natural Environment Research Council award winner Sofer Sue Ermagasson, to work out how this new government policy may impact the future of our insects, as well as other government targets which are committed to reverse declines in biodiversity. It was a fascinating conversation about the importance of invertebrates in our landscape and how net gain in its current guise may not be the answer to increase species diversity. Controversial. Take a listen. Nat, can you set the scene for our listeners about the population health of our insects here in the UK? Like, are they in a good place?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mixed bag with insects, I would say. There's been a lot of reports that insects are in catastrophic decline. The actual evidence suggests that it's more of a nuanced picture. Some insects are declining quite significantly, others are increasing. But overall, I'd say we should be quite concerned about the health of our insect populations, particularly some of those more specialised insects that have quite specific habitat requirements. They only live in certain places or under certain conditions, and they're not super mobile, they can't move easily place to place. Those are the ones that I think we need to be quite concerned about.
Can you tell us some of those special ones that you're talking about?
Yeah, for example, one of my favourites is called the necklace ground beetle, Carabus manilis. It's a beautiful, large bronze beetle, and it lives in quite specific places, primarily like floodplain meadows, of which there are only about 4 square miles left in the UK.
Right.
And yeah, they're not super mobile. They can't kind of fly between habitats. They rely on really good connectivity. So things like that we're quite concerned about.
Sounds beautiful.
It's very lovely.
You mentioned that there are some species in decline. Can you just tell us what the main drivers are for that downward trend?
Yeah, I would say there's a big mix of drivers. So things like habitat loss is a big one. Habitat fragmentation as well. Things like pesticides could also be playing a role. So the application of pesticides in agricultural settings, but also urban environments. Another one could be agricultural intensification. So kind of the rapid expansion of monoculture agriculture and taking out of hedgerows and things like that are important for insects.
Okay, I won't lie. I do have a slight phobia of some insects, and I would really love you to convince me why I should care about them.
Yeah, it's a really common question. I think the first answer is the kind of selfless, insect-loving answer, which is we should care because they are kind of beautiful, most of them. It's nice to share a country with things like purple emperor butterflies and, like we said, the bronze ground beetles. But if you want kind of a more selfish argument, they are very important for things like food security, so pollination, things like bees, butterflies, hoverflies, important pollinators. And then the things that people tend to like less, like spiders, can also be very important pest controllers. So they kind of take care of things that might otherwise eat our crops or eat things in our gardens that kind of munch on our vegetables. So yeah, they are very important for supporting things like food production and soil health. So that's the selfish answer.
No, selfish is fine. I mean, I have a fear. I do have one personal encounter where I watched a sable wasp. I can't tell you what species it was, but it was laying its ovipositor into a mushroom, a maize gill, an oak maize gill. And I remember this was last year, and I was just dumbfounded for about 30 seconds in that little snapshot of nature, just of life. I mean, I'm working on spiders. Okay. I am working on trying to like them more, because if they're a pest controller, that sounds good to me. We've been talking about insects generally, and you've been doing some research recently into analysing not only invertebrate biodiversity, but also their connection with the biodiversity net gain metric and how it scores, how the two score. Which brings us to an exclusive for our listeners then. Can you just tell us a bit about the parameters of your study and what you found?
Yeah, so we have been slightly concerned for a while now, a couple of years, that biodiversity net gain maybe isn't scoring habitats in a way that reflects their invertebrate value. So things like the way that the metric looks at habitat condition and scores if it's a good condition or a poor condition habitat. It penalizes things like scrub, so bramble, and also bare ground. So bare soil is used by a lot of ground nesting bees. So we were slightly concerned that the scoring might not be reflecting what we know to be important for invertebrate biodiversity. So to kind of actually look at this, we have been collecting ground invertebrates, so spiders, ground beetles, centipedes, millipedes, anything on the ground layer. We've been sampling those and using DNA metabarcoding, which is a DNA technology that extracts the DNA from all the insects and uses that to make a species identification, so saving a lot of time and effort. And we've been comparing our species samples for habitats with biodiversity metric scoring to see if there is a relationship between metric scoring and invertebrate abundance and richness and other different measures of communities. And that has been for grassland habitats in Oxfordshire.
That sounds really clever. Have you found a correlation?
Yeah, so there's a kind of a complex result here. We found that invertebrate species richness, so the number of species in a habitat, is not linked to metric scoring.
Right.
We found that invertebrate abundance is slightly more complex. Sometimes there is a relationship there in certain times of the year, but in most kind of cases there isn't that relationship there. I think invertebrate abundance can be linked to a lot of different things like weather, seasonality, so that one is maybe a bit harder to pin down. But the species richness result, we found no correlation there, and we found that within habitat types, which are treated the same in the metric, so if you have a neutral grassland here, a neutral grassland here, they're all treated the same scoring, they can be very, very variable. So that was kind of our big finding, that perhaps using habitat type and habitat condition alone are not going to represent invertebrate biodiversity.
That seems like an amazingly glaring hole in a nature policy. And you mentioned bramble earlier. I'm a massive fan of bramble, so flipping on my phobias, I love a good bramble and stinging nettles, Urtica dioica. People sort of underrate these plants. And I was looking through your paper. Can you give us an example where the metric sort of undervalues a habitat for net gain, but actually it's really popular for insect biodiversity?
Yeah, so on grasslands where we have quite diverse mosaics of things like bare soil, so there's no vegetation on it. We have kind of patches of scrub, and then kind of what we would think of as a typical grassland. That mosaic of different things can score quite poorly if there's too much scrub and too much bare ground. But in reality, that can be incredibly important because invertebrates have kind of different requirements at different life stages. So a ground nesting bee will require the bare soil present and then also the nectar and pollen resources. Things like the scrub and also nettles can be incredibly important resources. Beds of nettles can provide humidity on otherwise quite dry days for invertebrates. And also not just invertebrates, so scrub can also be really important for things like grass snakes as well, that might kind of set up shop in there. So yeah, having a more diverse habitat with a mix of different features will ultimately likely increase the invertebrate biodiversity. But under the metric, that's not seen as kind of valuable.
And I do find that so fascinating. Sorry to get stuck on stinging nettles. I just like them. But that is so interesting, isn't it? Because you've got some of these kind of not taken for granted plants, but I hadn't fully appreciated under the metric how it doesn't really want them. And yet I read here in your paper that 123 invertebrate species in the UK are actually associated with those shaded beds. I mean, that was an enormous, you know, number that just sort of threw me sideways. Does this mean then that we should be throwing the net gain metric out?
I would say definitely not. I think it has value. So thinking nettle is a good example. It's very context specific. If you have a very valuable meadow habitat with a diversity of plant species, you might want to think about keeping things like nettle and scrub under control so that they don't take over the floral diversity that's there. It's on these low and medium scoring habitats that these features in reasonable quantities can be very important. And the metric does a really good job of kind of priority setting, I would say. For a developer, if you have a high scoring habitat on site, you're incentivized to retain that and not damage it, which is exactly what we want. The problem comes with these low and medium scoring habitats that can kind of get this lower medium score, but can be incredibly variable. So you can have that really high biodiversity value there. So I think what we think is needed is retaining on the ground biodiversity measurements, so kind of collecting species data and using that to help kind of inform the decisions that you're making with the metric. So not relying solely on the metric. There are also kind of things that we think the metric could benefit from including. So things like connectivity would be a really nice addition to the metric, which is currently lacking.
You mentioned data recording. Who's going to do that?
Very good question. Yeah, so there's kind of a range of biodiversity groups that are sampled before development anyway. So things like protected species. We have a fantastic community of biological recorders in the UK who collect data that can then be used to support planning applications. And also the use of kind of novel technologies might also be quite helpful in this sphere. So environmental DNA is one of them. And bioacoustics is another.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we had Dr. Carlos Abrahams in the podcast studio recently. Fascinating field.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But there are a lot of invertebrate people out there who do this work, who will do invertebrate surveys. It's just not something that's currently required of development. But we think it's quite important to include some measure of invertebrates before going ahead with this.
So looking more broadly then at England's direction of travel in this field, we've got the 25-year Environment Plan, the Environment Act, we've got the Environment Improvement Plan, which sets out an overarching target to halt the decline in species abundance by 2030 and to exceed 2022 abundance levels by 10%. A bit of a mouthful there, but these are targets. From what you're saying, is there a danger that net gain at present could wreck some of these other plans?
Yeah, that's our concern, is that biodiversity net gain is not a tool for conservation. It's a tool for compensating for harms on the environment. But if it is kind of missing habitats that are important to invertebrates so significantly, it could start to detract from these other targets by assuming that all habitats that get this low score are not important for invertebrates. So yeah, that's the kind of the concern. It's not supposed to be directly a tool for conservation, but we don't want it to be detracting from our conservation targets.
And it's interesting, the numbers. I read that there are roughly 1,500 pollinating insect species in the UK. So we're talking a big number that might otherwise detract from these improvement targets. But presumably not all of those 1,500 are being monitored by the government for their targets.
Yeah, the targets and the kind of representation of biodiversity in them is something that I don't think it's the best. The species abundance target currently looks at priority species from the groups birds, mammals, butterflies and moths, which is quite a limited set, representing quite a kind of limited niche. So we've only got flying insects in there. We don't have any of the ground invertebrates. We don't have reptiles, amphibians even. So that kind of narrow scope, I think, could be is not great.
If you look at what we have as targets and ambitions, do you think we're going far enough on insects or more broadly wildlife in this country?
I don't think so. If you look at the trend of species abundance between the 1970s and now, most of the steep declines have been between the 1970s and the early 2000s. So setting the target to get 10% more than 2022 by 2042, I think is quite unambitious. I think we could be aiming much higher than just a little bit more than what we have right now.
And how do you go about monitoring that data? Are we relying on citizen scientists, or, you know, what's the answer there if we want to try and take a healthier measurement of, you know, to protect our wildlife?
I'm not actually 100% sure how the species abundance index is being monitored and kind of evaluated, but I think what the Office for Environmental Protection highlighted was that there seems to be a kind of lack of planning and kind of setting out how we're going to achieve the target. So there's kind of concerns that we're not moving fast enough. The target might be achievable because it's not huge, but unless we're setting out actions and steps to move towards it, then we might kind of not get there.
And then what's next for biodiversity net gain, do you think? Where does it need to move to?
That's a great question. I think what we would quite like to see is scaling of the percentage net gain required. Well, some councils are requiring more than 10% net gain, so 20%, perhaps even more than that. And I think that's a really positive step. So I think once we've kind of rolled out the 10%, everyone's got used to what they're expected to do. I think increasing that and 20% is not a huge jump for many developments. I think that's a really nice direction of travel to be taking.
Okay, this is a slight deviation, but I hope an interesting one. And my final question for you. So you're now in charge of DEFRA, and Natural England's biodiversity net gain teams, as well as commander of any other units you like. You are the net gain czar of government, all regulators and regulators, everything, Nat. You are everything. You have the budget and the resources in abundance. What would you do in your first 6 months in office?
I'm not sure that my answer will be incredibly exciting, but I think for ensuring the success of biodiversity net gain, I would use my newfound power to scale up resources within local planning authorities so that they're able to monitor biodiversity net gain and enforce non-compliance, because I think we can design a metric that's perfect, but if the monitoring and the enforcement isn't happening, then it kind of falls flat. And the other thing I would do is create a more transparent offsite register. That was something that came out this week, actually, was the first sites on the offsite register. So the kind of habitat banks and gains being made offsite that developers can purchase. And so far, that's not been very transparent. So I would increase the transparency of that so that we can kind of better monitor and measure the outcomes of the policy.
Succinct and clear actions. I like it. You've got my vote. Nat, thank you so much for coming on to the Eco Chamber. It has actually been a real pleasure, and I think I actually like bugs a little bit more as a result of this conversation.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that's it. We've come to the end of this week's Eco Chamber. My thanks to Pippa Neal, Tess Colley, and Nat Duffus for exploring this week's episode, helping me, and I hope you, get to grips with the biggest issues of the week and the plight of our insects. We need to value them better. We would love to hear from you, listeners, with your thoughts, views, and opinions. You can reach us by emailing ecochamber@haymarket.com or on our socials using the hashtag ecochamber. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and maybe even share it with a friend. Until the next time, take care.